This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some pretty incredible stories of the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and along the way, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired, and I know all three of those are going to be true today as we visit with 94-year-old Jack Leonard of Clovis, California. Now, I say 94 only because I know you're not going to believe he's 94 when you hear him speak. But let's go way back to the beginning. Growing up in Casper, Wyoming, you had three brothers and one sister, and I bet you had a good jacket because it gets cold in Casper, Wyoming. What was your childhood like back there?
Well, it was cold. About the only thing you can say about it, it was cold. We looked forward to summer. We had summer one year in July. On the 4th of July, we had summer. But we just went to school there and just lived. But in 1939, got 42 below zero. And I told my mother, I said, you know, Mom, no white men and darn few Indians can survive in this climate. I'm going to find me a warm climate. And in 1940, I joined the service.
So this is far before Pearl Harbor. You had already graduated from high school. Were you thinking that the military was going to be a career for you, or what kind of ambitions did you have?
My ambitions were few. I didn't have any ambitions, really. I didn't know anything. I just had a high school education. I got encouraged to enlist in the service because the two senators from Wyoming were in Fort Washakie, Wyoming. And I happened to be there at the time teaching the Drum and Bugle Corps. And we rode around the lake, Fort Washakie, while they were fishing. And they were talking, Senator Joe Homahony and Harry Schwartz. And Harry Schwartz's daughter and I went to school together, high school together. So anyhow, they were saying about what Roosevelt was going to do, what he was going to do, that he was going to get the draft and all that. Then they started talking to me. And they said, what are you going to do? And I had no opinion what I was going to do. I had this job teaching the Indian Drum Review Corps, didn't know where I was going to go from there. But they said, well, they would suggest that I join the service because there's going to be a selective service. And you'll be on the ground floor and you'll get promoted faster. So that was my encouragement to join the service. I didn't know where I was going to go from there, but I joined the service.
And I bet you had no idea what kind of work you were going to do in the military either.
None whatsoever. I was lucky to be enlisted in the Army Air Corps, which was fine for me. I didn't want to be a foot soldier, but I did enjoy the Army Air Corps.
And just about every veteran who I've interviewed who was in the Army Air Corps in World War II tells me that he went into that branch of the service because he wanted to be a pilot. Your older brother was a pilot, a fighter pilot in World War II. Did you have those ideas that you might be in the cockpit?
I did, but I had a couple of problems. I'm deaf in one ear, and I'm blind. And they didn't take pilots had to wear glasses. Then they had to hear also.
And let's clarify, when you say you're blind, that can give people a lot of different ideas. How impaired was your vision?
I was 22/20 in one eye and 22/100 in the other, and I was legally blind. But I had glasses about the size of a quarter inch on the side and paper thin in the middle, so I could see. I didn't get them until I was 8 years old. I saw a whole world that I hadn't seen before. I thought everybody saw the way I did until I got glasses. Then I realized there was a whole world out there.
And you would see a lot of that world in World War II, but the first place you saw, I guess, was
Moffett Field. At that time, Moffett Field had been taken over by the Air Corps as a fighter pilot training base, and that was where they were training radio operators for the Army Air Corps. And I started out to be a radio operator, learning the Morse code and learning to function on a bug and then do radio code.
Moffett Field was in the news recently because Google bought those big blimp hangars and a lot of that facility from the government, so we'll see what they're doing with it. Did they have those giant lighter-than-air blimp hangars there when you were there?
Oh, yes. That's where the offices alongside of the hangar were where we had our training schools. One day, I recall, I was listening to the radio, and all at once I heard this horrible noise. Both ends of the big dirigible hangar was open, and a fighter pilot, flew through the hangar. Leave us say he was no longer in the Air Corps. But anyhow, it was really something to hear the noise of it going through a closed building like that.
Wow. I wonder if that's the only time that that ever happened.
I don't have any idea whether that was the truth or not, but I know it happened while I was there.
Wow, yeah. And anyone that's ever seen those blimp hangers, and you can find a picture online real easy, Moffett Field in the Bay Area of California, there's not a lot of space in the, I mean, those are big doors. The 49ers used to send their punters in there to kick so they could simulate punting in a dome. But there's not a lot of leeway on either side for a plane to go through that whole thing.
Yeah, but the fighter pilots in those days was very, very small. They weren't very big. They would probably only had a wingspan of, I wouldn't say more than 100 feet, if that wasn't that much. So they could go through there quite easily.
And I could see how that sound would stick with you for a while. As far as the training that you had there, what kinds of things were you learning? And was it challenging for you, or was it a piece of cake?
I think it was a piece of cake to me because I enjoyed what I was doing. I was learning Morse code, dit-dots, and learning to type on a mill, which is a typewriter with just all capital letters, and it's for typing. And when you're copying code, Morse code, you copy it in sections of five characters, to then a space. And so I learned to do that, and it was very interesting. But along the way, they decided they were forming a new cadre up in Tacoma, Washington, at McCord Field. I was selected to go there with a group of about seven of us to form a new cadre for a new Signal Corps company. And they needed someone that could type, and so they promoted me from a private to a corporal and made me company clerk. And this was in September of 1940. So what the senators had told me, I get in on the ground floor, I got in on the ground floor.
I guess you did, and you just said September of 1940, so this is still more than a year before America ended up in the war. Did you have a sense that war was coming? Did you, you know, foresee things changing, or did you think, hey, this is just going to be fun, I'm going to be a clerk, I'm going to do this, and this is a good job?
I thought it was just a good job. I didn't think anything about war. Had no indication that was going to be anything about it at all. We didn't get any news until 1941.
Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in Portland, Oregon. There was a Portland Army Air Base. Where the Portland Airport is now was Portland Army Air Base. I was there for quite some time. I got there in May of 41, and I stayed there until I went to OCS, Officer Candidate School in New Jersey, in October of 42. I was a signal office sergeant in charge of the signal office at Portland Army Air Base.
So December 7th, 41, you're in Portland, Oregon. How did you hear the news? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, being a sergeant, I had my own room in the barracks. Early that Sunday morning, a couple of guys banged on my door and said, "Sergeant, the Japs have just bombed Pearl Harbor." So I had to leave. There were only two of us that could work the code machines. Everything was encoded and encrypted. And there were only two of us that could work it. It was my commanding officer and myself. I left my barracks and went to the signal office. And I was there 72 hours without sleep. And I went to sleep sitting at a teletype machine 72 hours later. But the only two of us, my commanding, I mean, he had other things to do. So that left me to do the encrypting.
And you say that very matter-of-factly, but hopefully people at home are hearing that and saying 72 hours, that's 3 days without sleeping a wink. What did that do to you emotionally or to your mindset to have all of a sudden, wow, we're at war? I'm sure you're imagining all kinds of possibilities in your own mind.
Well, all I thought about, we had a job to do. That was about it. I didn't think. We were so busy. The adrenaline was going. You didn't think about what's happening or where you were going or what's going to happen to you. All you thought about was the job that you were there to do at the time, and we did it. That's all we felt.
And you mentioned using those code machines and that the communications were done in code. And I have to think most people today have no idea what you're talking about. I've never seen one of these code machines or would have no clue how they would work. How complicated was this, and how did you operate those?
The code machines were a cylinder of letters and numbers, and it was probably about 8 inches long and about 2 inches round. We would have certain code for the day to what we would use, and then we'd use a code book, like A would be E. E would be something else, and those would be your codes for the day. So when you're encoding, if someone wanted to say, move squadron so-and-so with so-and-so there, well, you'd have to put it into language that no one could read, which would be coded, like the squadron might be spelled XYZPQ, you know.
Sure.
That could be squadron. And that's what's such a code machine. So we'd get those letters. We'd get the communication in our office. We'd have to decode it. And before we send anything out from the general, we'd have to encode it.
And were you allowed to tell anyone about what it was you were doing or any of that stuff that you just told me? Would you have been able to tell your family that or your brother that or your friend that?
No, we didn't say anything. We were high security.
So then you got that opportunity to go to officer candidate school, and you took them up on that. Did your activities intensify because there was a war going on now, or did you feel more of an urgency to what you were doing?
Well, I did. I went to many schools. I went to teletypewriter repair school. I went to maintenance of telephone central offices. I learned how to manage mess halls, restaurants, really. And then when I went to OCS, I was pretty much Army. All I had was Air Corps. I didn't know anything else in my life but the Air Corps. And so I thought that would be where I was going to go from there. And so from OCS, I was, my first assignment as a commissioned officer was going to be a teacher, an instructor in administration at Fort Monmouth. I was going to be one of the teachers there. But the day before graduation, they called three officers' names up from the platform. They were having a confrontation of all the officers are leaving graduation. They said, these three officers' orders have been changed. And my orders were changed. Mine was the first ones changed. Lieutenant Jack Leonard was going to be assigned to Camp Pinedale, Fresno, California. In January of 1943, I landed in Fresno, California, in Camp Pinedale.
That was a pretty fateful change of orders, as we're going to find out. But if they hadn't been changed, what would have happened to you? What do you think your life would have been like?
I really don't know, because then I would have stayed at Fort Monmouth as a teacher. And as a teacher, I don't know what would have happened to me, if I, how long I would have stayed there, or whether we would have found a combat unit to go to. I don't have any idea. All I know is I was sent out here to join a combat unit. When I say a combat unit, supporting the combat soldiers, not a combat unit. We did the support. We were a single corps. We would copy the radio transfer, Japan radio. I knew it was Japan. We would encode it for do the best we could. I was sent to Washington, D.C. to intelligence school, where I learned cryptography, cryptanalysis, and I studied Japanese.
And I bring up, you know, I'm probing that statement about the change of orders, because I know that if you hadn't been sent to Fresno, you never would have met a young lady who just turned 90 years old and you've been married to for 70 years. I guess that was a pretty fateful assignment, huh?
I'll tell you, it was the best assignment I ever had in my life. I have to tell you about that. We had a big bond drive at Camp Pinedale in 1943, in September 43. Well, on September 30th, they had a big ball for the bonds, for war bonds. They war bonds during World War II. That's the way they financed the war, was war bonds. Anyhow, my squadron sold the most war bonds. So our team were going to escort the Queen and her court to the ball that night. Officers weren't invited, only enlisted men. So Maxine was my wife now, was the Queen. So I called her up. I asked her if she, I was raffling off about 50 war bonds. So I called her up and I asked her if she'd come down to my office and pull the raffle, because and meet the sergeant that was going to be her escort for the ball. And so she very, very accommodatingly said yes. Well, when she walked in the door, here I am, a smart aleck, second lieutenant, hat in the back of my head, dark glasses on in my office, my feet on the desk. She comes to the door. I said, she's mine. And to myself, I said, she's mine. And my hat, glasses came off, my feet go on the floor, and we did the bond rally. Took me about 10 days to get nerve enough to ask her for a date.
Because, as you said, this was for all the enlisted men, so you didn't actually go to this ball that she was going to be presiding over, but you built up the nerve to call her up and arrange another meeting, huh?
I did, and we went out to dinner and a movie, and when I dropped her off at the home that night, I said, will you marry me?
First date.
Uh-huh. And she said, you can't be serious. I said, I am serious. Well, a year later, we were married. And it was the best move I ever had. And you know what? God found her for me, and God placed me here at that time. That's the only thing I can attribute it to, because she was mine the minute I saw her.
And she still is 70 years later, but don't you think we should get her side of the story, at least of how they met? I think we should, and we're going to do that when we come back. If you want to see what Jack and Maxine Leonard looked like then and what they look like now, punch in Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. We'll hear from Maxine when we come back and find out what Jack was up to once he went overseas in the Pacific during World War II. Before we're done, we'll also hear about Jack's older brother who did not come home from the war and the perspective that produces for Jack. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.